And now, in a moment, the author of the best-selling A Thousand Splendid Suns. But first, Hamas fighters continue to pound security installations in Gaza City today, brutally executing Fatah guards. They'd also seized control of two of Gaza's four main cities when we reached Reuters correspondent Nidal Amurabi in Gaza moments ago. We asked him for the latest on this battle between Hamas and Fatah, who share the seat of Palestinian government power.
The latest was that Hamas fighters have just stormed another strategic Fatah security compound in Gaza City, which is the general intelligence, which falls directly under the command of President Mahmoud Abbas. Fighters from Hamas stormed the building, and they are now confiscating files and arms and vehicles they have found inside the compound. At the same time, Hamas gunmen are pounding two other strategic compounds in the Gaza City, which virtually the last two castles remaining of the Fatah authority at the moment.
Nidal, am I hearing gunfire behind you?
Yes, the gunfire we're hearing, it's near the compound of President Mahmoud Abbas, as his forces at the moment are exchanging fire with Hamas gunmen who are bounding the compound and within of the compound with mortar bombs, nonstop.
Do we know if Abbas is in the compound? Are they actually going after President Abbas?
No, because we know that President Abbas is currently in Ramallah, in the West Bank at the moment, and according to his aides, he is expected to make some fateful decisions, they called it, in order to confront the Hamas military offensive in the Gaza Strip.
Fatah forces outnumber Hamas forces, but Fatah forces say they lack leadership, they lack weapons, and also we're being told that Hamas may have been stockpiling weapons for a while, but how else do you explain what seems to be their success?
The problem is that Fatah, while bigger in number, they have a decentralized command. They have many splinter groups within themselves. There is no one source of finance. And there are lots of disputes and anarchy, if we want to say, and feudings.
Right.
While the Hamas is seen by analysts as more integrated, and they have their own arms factories in the Gaza Strip.
Do we understand as well that they have faith? One top Hamas leader told Hamas Radio today that this is a battle between Muslims and non-believers. God willing, we will lead the Friday prayer in the president's office. We'd been hearing that Palestinian movements were nationalistic. Has the Hamas movement become, or is it more Islamist?
I believe that this is a justification Hamas leaders are making in order to justify for the Palestinians who are entirely Sunni, Muslims Sunni. They want to try to justify why they are fighting their own Muslim brothers. They have no other reasons to say but to tell the people that it is a fight between Muslims and non-believers.
Well, I was going to ask you, Nidal, before we let you go, and I want you to be safe, what are ordinary Palestinians doing besides trying to stay off the streets? Are they taking up with either of the groups? Are they trying to stay away from the fighters? How are they responding?
People are very skeptical about their future. They are very worried. The question that they have is that Hamas now takes control. What is the future of Gaza? The situation already looks grim. But most of the ordinary Palestinians expect that this situation will go more grimmer and more bitter.
Nidal Amurabi, Reuters correspondent in Gaza. We hear the firefight behind him. Nidal, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, war is at the core of author Khaled Hosseini's new novel, A Thousand Splendid Suns. Hosseini's 2003 debut novel, The Kite Runner, told the story of two Afghan boys, inseparable friends, then separated by an act of cowardice. Splendid Suns, S-U-N-S, is actually about daughters of Hosseini's native Afghanistan, the claustrophobic, reduced lives of women in Kabul, trapped by society and a cycle of war.
They listen to the whistling, forks in midair, unchewed food in their mouths. Laila saw the reflection of their half-lit faces in the pitch-black window, their shadows unmoving on the wall, the whistling, and then the blast, blissfully elsewhere, followed by an expulsion of breath, and the knowledge that they had been spared for now, while somewhere else, amid cries and choking clouds of smoke, there was a scrambling, a bare-handed frenzy of digging, of pulling from the debris what remained of a sister, a brother, a grandchild.
Laila is well-educated and urban, her friend Mariam poor and illiterate, but both become entombed by war and the burqas they're forced to wear. Their bond grows as they anxiously wait to be ambushed by each new horror, and there are many. Author Khaled Hosseini joins us now with more. Welcome.
Hi.
Difficult to read, but difficult to put down. And, you know, many Americans know that women and children in particular suffered in Afghanistan. But did you ever worry you'd run the risk of people saying, oh, it can't be that bad?
Yeah, and actually, that's what I thought myself. It can't be that bad. And then you go out there, and I actually went to Kabul in 2003 and came face to face with just how bad it can be.
Which brings us to the story of Laila and Mariam, the two women, your fictional characters. Let's tell their story. It begins with Mariam. A harami, is that how you say it? She's called a harami, a mugwort, an illegitimate child. A mugwort, a weed that you just pluck. She lives with her unstable, at this point, mom. And Mariam's life begins to unravel the night she attempts to demand recognition from her father, who sort of set her up away from his privileged family.
Well, Mariam is the illegitimate child of this lowly villager and this wealthy businessman. And she doesn't really understand in a true way the socioeconomic chasm that exists between her and her father, who lives with his
three wives
and 10 legitimate children out in the city, while Mariam lives in a hut on the outskirts of this remote village. And Mariam is very naive. She doesn't really understand her place. And so she tries to force her fate. And she dreams of living in her father's house, and she dreams that she will be an accepted member of his family, that he will embrace her as his loving daughter, and comes face to face with a very cruel answer, and her illusions are shattered about her life and about her father.
Well, and here you see how women are set up against each other, which happens a lot in the book. And in this case, the three wives of the father see her as a threat and arrange to have her married off to some brutish fellow. And off Mariam goes in, you know, the first in a series of betrayals in the book. She's married to a shoe salesman, Rashid. And at first she thinks, well, maybe I can do this. She's trying to adapt. And for instance, there's a scene where she's forced to wear a burqa, which she'd never worn before.
The thing that I find touching in that character is that the things that she wants are so ordinary. They're so mundane. You know, she doesn't want a mansion or these cars. I mean, she wants to be acknowledged as a human being who somehow matters, and that her existence had some kind of consequence on the people around her. And so there's this recurring image of weed, you know, something that was never invited, something that is dismissed, that can be ripped and tossed aside. And so these are the things Mariam wants. And in the kind of the unsure first few days of her marriage, she actually thinks she might have found that with this stranger.
Here's a passage, though, 4 years in. It wasn't easy tolerating him talking this way to her. He told her to shut up, to bear his scorn, his ridicule, his insults, his walking past her like she was nothing but a house cat. But after 4 years of marriage, Mariam saw clearly how much a woman could tolerate when she was afraid.
Yeah. Early on in the novel, Mariam's mother says, look, there's really only one thing a woman like you and me needs to be able to do. There's only one skill you need to learn, and that's to endure. And that is something that at the time Mariam kind of hears and dismisses. But she has multiple opportunities to put that advice to the test.
Well, her life's becoming more and more and more reduced. She cannot have children. And this infuriates her husband and disappoints her. Then we begin part two of the novel with the story of a young beauty, Laila, educated, madly in love with her childhood friend, Tariq. Her brothers are off with the Mujahideen fighting the Soviets. Her scholarly father is just sort of bewildered at life. And her mother is also unbalanced,
Well, her mother is I don't think she's quite unbalanced, as she is profoundly depressed. Her two sons that she absolutely idolizes and loves have gone to war. And the chronic depression in Afghan women has an astronomical rate. And I don't think that Laila's mother is so much unhinged as she is just terribly, terribly depressed. And as a result of her depression, she's not a very good mother to Laila, and kind of neglects her in many ways. And Laila finds solace with her friend Tariq, and really with her father, who in many ways is much closer to her than her mother is. Her father is very supportive of her. He's actually the negative of the character of Rashid, who is a brute.
The opposite,
is very oppressive. Laila's father is actually, for all practical purposes, a feminist. I mean, he wants her to finish high school, go to college, get a degree, become a professional, marry later in life after she's been educated. So he's a very different kind of man.
Yeah, but he seems doomed. I mean, he just seems too fragile a flower for what's happening in Afghanistan. And sure enough, the missile strikes them. The father is killed. She's pulled from the rubble by Rashid, Mariam's husband, who you think he's her savior, but he's not. There's another forced marriage.
Well, the heart of this novel for me is the relationship between these two women who come from such disparate backgrounds, born a generation apart, have very, very different visions about their own lives. And that was the big what if for me in actually writing. I was like, what if these two women were thrown in the same household, and what would happen between them? And so the heart and soul of this novel is this evolving relationship between these two women who, much to their own surprise, find something in the other woman that fills a void in their own lives. And the relationship begins adversarial and eventually softens and develops into something powerful, meaningful, and mother-daughter-like.
As their lives are just more and more degraded. I don't know if you meant them as sort of a metaphor for just, you know, Afghanistan, hammered by constant war, but they are more and more insulated, more and more isolated, more and more ravaged. There's times when they're starving.
You know, somebody wrote in a paper the other day that it seems impossible to write melodrama set in Afghanistan because everything is already so melodramatic.
Yeah.
There's virtually nothing I've written in this novel that isn't based in some form of truth. Many of the anecdotes in the novel, sadly, are lifted virtually verbatim from things that I saw and heard in Afghanistan.
That's Khaled Hosseini, author of A Thousand Splendid Sons, the best-selling novel about the realities of Afghanistan from the Soviet invasion through battling warlords and then the Taliban, and also the imagined lives of two women. Well, theirs is a world where women undergo cesarean sections without anesthesia because the Taliban has closed all women's hospitals, where women are held in rooms with windows nailed shut, their infants near death for lack of water because a husband has been angered. When we come back, though, a sliver of hope in the novel, if not in the country, we'll ask Khaled. And later, a final farewell to journalist David Halberstam. Back after a quick break, here and now. It's here and now. We're back with Khaled Hosseini, author of A Thousand Splendid Sons, currently number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And we left off in the middle of the novel when Laila, a teenage girl, orphaned and left alone in Kabul, is forced into marriage with a middle-aged shoe salesman named Rashid, who's already married to another desperate woman named Mariam. These two women, a generation apart, form a unique bond. And through them, we see the life of Afghanistan, spanning the Soviet invasion of the 1980s, the rise of the Mujahideen, who oust the Soviets only to then turn on each other, and then years later, of course, the rise of the Taliban. Khaled, at one point in the novel, Laila even seems to wistfully yearn for the days of the Soviets, even though she remembers a former teacher who encouraged children to spy on their parents. That teacher also stood for more freedom for women.
Yeah, it's kind of this spiraling of this unraveling of the country that makes people almost wistful for days that were not so good to begin with. You know, the turmoil outside of the doors of the household of these two women in many ways determines their inner lives and what happens to them inside the household. Mm-hmm. And there are times when Laila actually wishes for the days of the Soviets, when at least there was peace in Kabul, when at least she could go to school and have a semblance of a normal life.
Well, we're not going to give away the ending or even the last third, except to say that your chest tightens the whole time. But at the very end, there is some hope. The U.S. invades. And I had to think as I got to those last pages, you must have written that prior to the current news of the resurgence of the Taliban, of violence in Afghanistan. And I should tell you that as we hear the current news, I find myself thinking of your characters.
Yeah. Well, that's, I appreciate that. I actually wrote these scenes, many of them, in 2006, which was a very, very violent year in Afghanistan in terms of the fighting. But the story ends in March of 2003, which was a time when I was in Kabul myself. And I remember the mood of the city at that time. And I remember the kind of this pervasive optimism and so on. But there were already grumblings that the money wasn't coming in like promised and the things weren't improving as quickly as people had hoped. And in fact, in that last chapter, there is an allusion to that, there's this character who recites this very optimistic poem about the future of Afghanistan as his answer to those in Kabul in 2003 who are already saying that, look, the money's not coming in, the Taliban are going to come back with a vengeance, and that the West is going to forget about Afghanistan again. The novel is, in many ways, very dark, and these women go through a great deal in this novel, their hardship and their suffering. And I wanted to end this novel on a note of optimism, on a note of hope. I am kind of an optimistic person, and I wanted the end of this novel to have some redeeming quality to it, without going overboard.
But what do you think now? I mean, do you find yourself thinking of Lila, for instance? Do you find yourself thinking, oh, you know, is she safe from the resurgent Taliban? You know, she's a fictional character, I know, but based on people you met.
I think about the people that I met back in 2003 and what happened to them, the ordinary hotel doorsmen, the kebab sellers on the street, the barbers and people that I met. Now I wonder, you know, how their lives have moved on. I do. I mean, I think if you speak to most Afghans, they would say that they would have thought things would have moved along farther than they have. Also, I think it would be wrong not to mention some of the good things that have happened in Afghanistan is not all bad. As flawed a process as it may be, we do have a parliament in which women sit. Yes, they're threatened. Yes, they're intimidated, but they're there. Yes, their mics get be turned off at times, but they're there. We did hold democratic elections. There's, at least in Kabul and other urban areas, there's more individual freedom. But that said, the future of Afghanistan is uncertain. And it remains hopelessly dependent on the West at this point.
You're now an envoy for the UN Refugee Agency. You've traveled to Chad. You include in the book different storylines, including refugees. Layla's boyfriend and his family become refugees. She thinks they're killed at one point. There are women who try to flee, you know, as refugees, and they get betrayed at the border. I mean, what do you, you know, through the book also, what do you want people to know about refugees?
Well, I mean, I came to the States as the most fortunate refugee of all time in a way. I mean, I came here as a political refugee. In the 80s, Afghanistan had, I think, more than 8 million refugees.
So this was after the Soviet invasion?
Yes, during the Soviet invasion. You know, my role with the UN Refugee Agency is to raise awareness about the plight of refugees around the world. Yeah. Having gone to Eastern Chad and having seen just how much people there depend on the humanitarian staff on the ground for their very existence, you know, it made me realize how dependent people are on the generosity and the support of people in the West.
Khaled Hosseini, again, author of A Thousand Splendid Sons. A couple last quick questions. Mm-hmm. The title, from a poem?
From a poem written in the 17th century by a poet named Saib Tabrizi, who lived in Iran at the time under a rather austere and oppressive kingdom, who did not approve of poetry and poets. And so he actually went to Kabul and was revered there by the leaders in Kabul and by the people in Kabul. And he developed a kind of a love relationship with the city. And he wrote this beautiful poem about the city of Kabul. And I used two lines. One cannot count the shimmering moons on her roofs or the thousand splendid suns that hide behind her walls.
And it's suns, S-U-N-S.
Yes.
But again, a book about women. And so one last question. What are you saying about and to men in Afghanistan?
Yeah, Afghanistan is not a homogenous country. There are parts of Afghanistan where for centuries women have been confined to their homes, have had to cover, have never really played any significant role in public life. have rarely received education and have been told who to marry, when to marry, and so on and so forth. And in those conservative tribal regions is where the work is needed. But I think that is one of the central challenges of this regime, is how do you give voice to women in areas where they've been voiceless for so long?
Khaled Hosseini, the new book, A Thousand Splendid Sons. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Okay, still ahead today, Americans and Vietnamese remember their good friend and colleague, author David Halberstam. That's Here and Now. Here and Now. On Tuesday, workers readied Manhattan's Riverside Church. A soloist rehearsed. They were preparing for the memorial service for author David Halberstam, who died April 23rd in a car accident. One row of pews was reserved for his fellow fishermen, another for firemen he chronicled after 9/11. Then, of course, there were seats reserved for his fellow giants in journalism, Ben Bradley, Gay Talese, Neil Sheehan, author of A Bright Shining Lie.
Do you want to sit?
No, I'm okay.
Sheehan was a patriotic 20-something when he and a young Halberstam met in Vietnam in 1963 and banded together to get at the truth of the war.
It was a companionship that really began there and lasted all our lives.
I remember one anecdote. I don't know why this one jumps out, but that someone came and told him that he should go to a certain corner. And he went to that corner where that terrible scene unfolded of the monk who set himself on fire in protest. Were you there that day?
That was a curious thing. We'd been under great criticism from the commanding general and the ambassador. They were claiming that we weren't going out in the field anymore. We weren't going out to see the war. Well, that morning I happened to go out on an operation out in the field. But there was another fellow from UPI who was in covering with me, and he and David went to that demonstration where that monk burned himself, yes. His name was Thich Quang Duc.
I'm sorry?
The monk's name was Thich Quang Duc.
It was an image that horrified people, and it's a reminder that it was people like David Halberstam and the photographer making sure they were there, otherwise it almost wouldn't have mattered.
That's true. If we hadn't been there, it wouldn't have mattered. And we understood that. We understood that it was terribly important that we be there to cover these demonstrations and to cover the war, because if we weren't there, there was no one bearing witness. The regime didn't want us covering these demonstrations, and they tried to frighten us off.
South Vietnamese,
the Diem regime. And in an alley one day, when we were waiting to cover a demonstration, the plainclothes police jumped Peter Arnett, and they got him down on the ground, and they were going to start kicking him with their pointy-toed shoes that they wore. And David charged like a bull, just yelled and charged, and knocked three or four of them aside. Because David was a great big man, 6'2", right muscle and bone, you know, broad shoulders. He just knocked these policemen aside, and stood over Peter with his fists up saying, get back, you sons of bitches, I'll beat the shit out of you. And then, which gave time for the rest of us to reach under him and pull Peter up to his feet. But I'll never forget that. David's immediately instinct was to charge and knock them out of the way. He was a wonderful, he was always there.
Do you have a hard time accepting that someone could make it through that? And then, you know, a car accident. I mean, your thoughts when you heard that he died?
I was brokenhearted when I heard that he died. It was a friendship that lasted 45 years. That's a long time. And so I was devastated when I got the news. But that's one of the terrible ironies of life. That's what happens. And he went, it was his destiny that he went out on the flood tide. He's, you know, some of us will grow old and decrepit, and David never will.
What did you say? He went out on the tide.
He went out on the flood tide. It would be better if he were here, obviously. I'll always miss him every day of my life. But there's a certain destiny that we all have, and his destiny was to go out in the flood tide.
New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins also spoke at the service. He said reporters today in Iraq ask themselves, what would David do? Paul Simon played. Columnist Anna Quinlan spoke of how if complete strangers called David and said they were going to Vietnam, he'd direct them to his interpreter.
Kong, you made it.
Yeah.
You might remember Kong. He was also my guide on a Vietnam trip. Thanks to friends of David's, he is here.
I am very special because this is the memorial service for David Halberstam. And with hundreds of people in black suit, necktie, and white hair, that means they are elder, they are intellectual, and only one of me from Vietnam. Out of 82 million Vietnamese, I can come here. So for me, this is like a heaven. I hope David smiled to me from the heaven.
It's kind of been bittersweet, you know, that you were able to come here, but sadly, David's not your guide here.
Maybe David's death is my visa to come to the state. It is a set. But I think he smiled to me from his word now. Without his death, I don't think I can come, especially after 9/11. Yeah.
Yeah, that is an irony. It is just because you, when you applied for a visa, you said you wanted to come to David Halberstam's memorial, and that is the reason you got in.
Right. And then I have to show to the consulate the photo taken with David when he visit, and then the invitation letter from Jean, and then that is the evidence for me to come.
Jean, his wife. What did you think of America? You made your way from San Francisco down through Los Angeles. What do you think of America?
Yesterday, some people take me to the top of the rock, and today another lady took me to the subway, so I can see New York vertically, and this is the first subway in my life.
What do you think?
Oh, wonderful.
How about the Grand Canyon?
Grand Canyon is New York turned upside down. And New York, like at the top of the rock, is a Grand Canyon turned downside up.
30 Rockefeller Plaza.
Right, right. Oh, incredible. I'm just a normal tour guide, but in Vietnam, we believe there is the wind of luck. So maybe the wind of luck bring me to David Halberstam. I am like the second-hand best and brightest, and he is the real best and brightest. So just the wind of luck bring us together, yeah, on this crowded and turbulent world. And I like the last singing, America Beautiful. Yeah, and it's really beautiful to me now. I want to read the lyrics carefully tomorrow, because normally mention about the country, they mention heroic, they mention about the war, but this is the song with very nice title, America, the beautiful America. Yeah.
Do you think David would have approved of that song?
He hoped to. He hoped that way. But how to make American more beautiful. Yeah, that is his dream.
David Halberstam's memorial this week was attended by over 1,000 people. His last book on the Korean War is scheduled for release in September. You're listening to Here and Now. At the Halberstam Memorial, Tom Herman, who's making a film about the Vietnam-era reporting of David Halberstam, pointed out to me that picture of heiress Paris Hilton crying through the window of a Los Angeles sheriff's cruiser. Did you see it? Her face is contorted with tears as she's brought back to court from her home. She was eventually sent back to jail for repeated parole violations. Well, did you notice the byline? Many of the mourners at David Halberstam's memorial service in New York probably did. They'd worked with the photographer Nick Ut in Vietnam, and you know his work as well. In 1972, Vietnamese Nick Ut became an AP photographer and reached the village of Trang Bang, about 25 miles from Saigon, where he took the iconic image of that naked Vietnamese girl running away from a napalm attack. That picture won Nick a Pulitzer Prize and brought the horror of an increasingly unpopular war home to Americans. And get this, that photo was taken June 8th, 35 years to the day before the Paris Hilton shot, the irony of which has bloggers buzzing. So photographer Nick Ut joins us on the line now from Los Angeles. Nick, when you took that picture, did you know it was the same day?
Yeah, when I took a picture of Paris Hilton, I shot a picture right away. I remember 35 years ago, same day when I took a picture, almost same hour.
Almost same hour, because you know.
Yeah, I can look her face almost like exactly like Kim Phúc when she screaming.
The face of Paris Hilton,
yeah,
is contorted in the way that, and the little girl's name, Kim Phúc?
Kim Phúc. She run from the napalm.
Yeah. I mean, it struck all of us at the memorial service that the faces were contorted in the same way, but of course, the lives completely different. But you saw that as well.
Yeah, then I talked to her yesterday.
You talked with Kim Phúc, the little girl?
Yeah, I talked to her yesterday. We talked about my picture, Paris Hilton. She laughed at my telephone.
She laughed.
Yeah.
Well, because very different lives. And
Different lives because she, Kim, every time I look at her picture, I cry sometimes.
You still do?
Yeah, you do, yeah.
We should tell people you saved that little girl's life. After you took the picture, you picked her up. Yes, you did. Got her to a hospital.
Yeah.
And you stayed in touch.
Yeah. After I took a picture of Kim Phúc, then I light up my camera, I pick her up, and you know, carry it to my car and from there to the hospital, save her life. Mm-hmm. I saw her body burn so bad. I don't want she die. That's why I want to say.
In fact, you insisted that the hospital at first didn't care that much about kids. They were treating troops, but you insisted that she be taken care of. And she calls you Uncle Nick, we know.
She called me Uncle Nick, right. Yeah.
You know, a lot of us were surprised to see your byline, but you're an Associated Press photographer. You go where they send you.
Yeah.
Do you wish that instead of chasing with the mob after an heiress who has her own problems, but let's, you know, not at all the magnitude of war, do you wish you were in a war zone, or did you have enough of that?
I think enough. I'm not too young man anymore. You know, like today, I had a war in Hollywood, or chasing all movie star. And like the picture of Paris Hilton outside her house, crazy, like over 200 people, not easy shot.
It wasn't an easy shot, but it wasn't, you know, no napalm bombs were falling.
No napalm, but I had lucky with the picture of her screaming, you know. That my another 35-year June 8th, my lucky day.
I suppose it is. I also just want to have mentioned that you knew David Halberstam well, and it's so interesting that so many people at his memorial service, you know, you were there in spirit because of your byline.
Yeah, I would have been there with David for the ceremony, you know. I know David so well, then happened. I'm in Germany with another friend, Hostvat, a good friend, David.
Oh, so you were out of the country in Germany with Host Voss. Host Voss was the well-known photographer in Vietnam when you, and do I understand your brother were his assistants? You were just kids, and your brother was killed, and you insisted on replacing him to go out and get the pictures?
Yeah, my brother was killed in 1955, after a year later. My sister asked me about horse can hide Nicky. He's too young. He's only 15. But I said, I love to, you know, replay my brother.
Knowing that, you know, he died, you could have been killed too.
Yeah, that really, you know, every time I either go back to Kim Phúc, I get shot outside her house when a rocket hit Champlain.
You were wounded after you brought Kim Phúc home?
Yeah.
The little girl that...
little girl back on like 1 month later.
Well, Nick, we're happy to remember your work today as well. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
After a quick break, a salute to Father's Day, here and now. It's here and now, and Sunday is Father's Day, a day to shower dads with cards, neckties, socks, a way to celebrate relationships that come in all different shapes, sizes, and as producer Christopher Blagg discovered, sounds.
As a kid, you know, Dad just visually was so much different looking than all the other dads.
As Jake Brennan remembers it, his dad wasn't like the other dads in the neighborhood. His work hours were strange, his fashion sense stranger. On hot summer days, he used to show up at Jake's Little League games smothered in a black trench coat and sporting a huge afro. You see, Jake's dad, Dennis Brennan, is a working musician and songwriter. Not the arena rock star type, but the grind-it-out in bars and clubs four nights a week kind of musician. And he harbors no regrets about the choices he made.
I realized it early on. I think it bothered Jake, you know, but I think it bothered Justine, his sister, even more, just because, you know, I wasn't the normal guy. But I couldn't be, you know. I had to do what I was doing, you know, and that's the way it goes. But I tried to make up for it in other ways.
Dennis Brennan's dedication and skill brought him critical acclaim. He's known as a musician's musician, a cult favorite in the Americana roots rock world. As it turns out, his son Jake followed in his father's footsteps. Kinda. That's Jake as the lead screamer in the hardcore band Cast Iron Hike. And while it's a time-honored tradition for teens to freak their parents out with their less than wholesome musical tastes, Jake's adolescent rebellion found little resistance from his dad.
I remember reading interviews with the Beastie Boys, and they talk about P-Funk and the Meters and all the stuff that they were sampling and into and trying to recreate. And that was the first time I heard of those bands, and I didn't even have to ask my father. I could just go to his music room and go through his records, and those records were there for me. And I didn't even have to spend any money. I could just tape them, you know, or steal them, which happened.
I usually get them back.
Yeah, I got them back. So, yeah, I would raid his record collection, and I think that, you know, obviously was an influence.
With a father who played rock and roll for a living, one would assume Jake thought his dad was the coolest guy on the planet. But it seems the universal rules of uncool dads holds true, even if dad takes a Stratocaster to work.
I think he was always uncool until...
If you're a dad and you're not uncool, then you're doing something wrong.
Right? Yeah, I mean...
If your kids think that you're a cool guy, you know, you can just kind of forget it as far as being a father goes, you know. If I did one thing that was trying to be cool, but also I think was the right thing to do, was I realized early on with both my children, both Jacob and Justine, that to be upset by anything is sort of the wrong thing, this message to send to a kid, you know, because it restricts them. But I sort of let them just do what they wanted to do as far as that goes.
By the time Jake started his own band after high school and began his own life as a working musician, his father's cool factor increased exponentially.
Around that time, we were old enough, the guys in my band, we developed an appreciation for my dad's band, and we would go see him all the time. Also coincided with right around the time we started to legally be able to go to bars. To us, what he was doing musically was so radically different than anything else that was going on out there, that to us, it was punk rock. These white guys playing this real greasy soul music was new to us, you know, and I think that's when he became cool in all of our eyes.
After leaving his hardcore band, Jake started gravitating more towards the kind of music his father plays, with maybe a bit more punk attitude, perhaps. On a recent night at a Boston-area bar, Dennis's blues band, the White Owls, takes a break, and the father calls his son up to stage to trade verses on a Jimmy Reed tune called Take Out Some Insurance. It's their voices more than anything that's the dead giveaway to their shared DNA. You better get some insurance on me, baby. Take out some insurance on me, baby. Cause if we ever, ever say goodbye, I'm gonna haul right off and die. Don't you get no sick an accident, cause I'm healthy as I can be. Now if you want my heart, you know, sweetheart, you put the payment on me. Darling, I will love you.
These days, Jake's latest project is an electronica band called the Teddy Boys. It may seem a far cry from his dad's roots rock, but keep listening. Under the sputtering electronic beats and samples, Jake's singing a verse from his dad's first album, a song called Bobby Moore's Bridge. He's come full circle.
Anything, I see how much further along his talent is than mine. And I mean, I don't say that, I'm not saying that to be cute or because it's the right thing to say. I really honestly believe it, especially singing. It's like that master level, you know, blows my mind, blows everyone's mind. I stopped bringing girlfriends to see my dad a long time ago because yeah. They were more interested in the elder statesman of the family.
There comes a point in many father-son relationships when the son is able to eclipse the father, maybe in chess or basketball or even poker. But for the Brennans, a father-son rivalry doesn't seem to be in the cards.
You can't help but be competitive with musicians, especially in this ridiculous town that we live in. But I've never once even felt any sort of competition or rivalry with you, ever. Not even, except, yeah, I guess when we play live, I feel like I need to go up there and I really need to, like, kick ass, but because he's so good, you know? I don't feel that way, and I think I can speak for you, too. I know you don't feel that way. At least I've never known that.
No, you just go and do the job. That's it, you know? That's the way it is. You know, if you have to worry about that, then, you know, Jesus, Jake's coming in, he's going to blow me away. I mean, it'll happen sooner or later. It hasn't happened yet. I remember what she said. She said, my, don't tell lies. Keep fidelity in your head. My, don't tell lies. When you're done your show, go to bed. Don't say hi like a spider to a fly. Jump right ahead, you're dead.
Dennis Brennan and his son, Jake. Christopher Blagg produced our story. For more on the Brennans and their music, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.